Recently, we did a webinar with Cormac Russell from Nurture Development, who is also responsible for helping to develop the ABCD network, which is the Asset-Based Community Development Network. The webinar we did with him was a really great webinar. It contained a lot of complexity and a lot of depth, so we've reproduced it here as a podcast so that you can listen to it at your leisure. We hope you will find it valuable and enjoy it.
Using a definition of community as the place where citizenship prevails is to talk about the rise and fall and rise again of associational life and how that has had a perverse or inverse relationship with the rise of consumerism in particular. And I don't want to lock the argument down into just capitalism, because in fact, this perverse relationship prevails in many countries that are not democratic or capitalist in nature. If you want to see really big institutions, look at the Soviet Union in historical terms. You see some of the biggest mental health hospitals, some of the biggest institutions that held people with varying degrees of labels. So the relationship between consumerism and community goes beyond capitalism. And I just want to talk a little bit about that through the lens of ABCD. I suppose there's four areas over the next 25 minutes or so that I'd like to talk specifically to. One is the theory that underpins ABCD and why it might be useful in this conversation. The second is the whole piece I've just set out there around the relationship between consumerism and community. I'd love if we had more time, and I think we should do a webinar that just focuses on the relationship between psychoanalysis and community and politics, because actually psychoanalysis from the 1900s, but particularly around the 1920s, had a profound influence in how we understand the concept of self, collective action, and politics more generally. But that's for another conversation. The third commentary I want to make is just around the challenges that we're facing at the moment in terms of social care, health, the challenge or the crisis perhaps in democracy and the crisis that we have in environment and economic terms. So I'll just say a word or two on that. And just finally, I'll finish with some thoughts around practical action, lest we completely become depressed and maybe reflect on how we can take advantage of a number of good crises that we're facing at the moment, and some observations I have around the rise again of community, which I think we're seeing currently, but not as we know it. I think what we're seeing is the rise of the below-the-radar groups, what I call the fourth leg of the stool. So that's my ambition for this webinar. In terms of cracking on, just to frame the conversation, I'd like to suggest that this is a complex conversation. A brain teaser that I quite enjoy comes from a book called Getting to Maybe, which I'm sure many of you have read, by Francis Wesley et al. But he asks the question, what's the difference between baking a cake, sending a rocket to the moon, and raising a child? And the answer to that conundrum is baking a cake is simple. If you've got the ingredients and some kind of a working recipe, pretty much anybody can do it. You don't need to be an expert. Sending a rocket to the moon requires expertise. It's a science. But once you've cracked the science and you've got the expertise to understand the science, you can send a rocket to the moon. And raising a child is not a science. Therefore, it's something different than what a science is, which is complicated. So baking a cake is simple. Sending a rocket to the moon is complicated. And raising a child is pretty unpredictable. It's emergent. You have two children, you raise them pretty much exactly the same, but one turns out one way or the other, seemingly completely different. And that's because it's complex. So the answer to the conundrum is one is simple, one is complicated, and one is complex. Social change is all three. But the distinguishing factor of social change is that it's complex, and community is complex, much more complex than rocket science because it involves people. One of the things that I think over this century of what some people call the self, over the last 100 years, we've begun to grapple with is some choices that seem to be almost outside of our own consciousness, choices around living a life of scarcity and consumption, where we're convinced that we purchase that which is beyond our need and basically purchase on the whim of the desire. that's created by the marketplace, or we can begin to think about lives of abundance. And this, I think, is at the heart of how ABCD frames the challenge that we find ourselves in today. We're told a lot at the moment, I think, that we have to figure out how to do more with less. I think that narrative is deeply problematic, as is an awful lot of the narrative around resilience, because it seems to me that the framing of that suggests that what is important is the money-based economy, power, expertise, and what I call the priestly class, when in fact I would argue that we need to do more with more, more social capital, more mutuality, more of a sense of our own capacity, more of a sense of what it is that we as citizens can only do. And I suppose the difficulty is when most of our narratives are framed within a consumerist context, it's very hard to have a conversation about mutuality and that which is beyond the marketplace without being colonized by the language of the marketplace itself. It's interesting because I suppose if somebody was to ask me to place the smoking gun of community life anywhere, I think I'd place it in the hands of the nephew of Sigmund Freud and the person who actually founded or started human relations, public relations, I should say, Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays, after the First World War, started to realize that he could use a lot of the theories that Sigmund Freud had come up with to begin to manipulate the masses. And I think that's exactly what we've seen the expansion and the extension of. What Bernays was doing really fascinated the American corporate world, because after World War One, this industry, the moguls of this industry were both rich and powerful, but they were also extremely worried. Because essentially the system of mass production that flourished during the war was now pouring out millions of products off the assembly line on a daily basis. And what they were frightened about was the danger of overproduction, that they would come to a point when people had enough goods and would simply stop buying. Because up to that point, the majority of citizens only bought on the basis of need. So they didn't actually have a culture that they could sell to that they have right now, which is a culture whereby we buy on the basis of wants, not needs. They had a culture that was basically, in the 1920s in any case, used to buying that which was necessity, not which was luxury, except the very wealthy. But the average American in particular bought on the basis of need. And they defined their needs on the basis of first checking to see what they had. So this was part of the psychology that was pre-1920s. What Bernays did was he changed that. He actually changed the way the average citizen purchased, not alone products, but eventually through the 20s, 30s, and 40s, post the Wall Street crash, he actually convinced people to buy not alone products from the marketplace, but also products from the world of politics. He was centrally influential in showing politicians how to manipulate the masses and control them. So again, like I said at the beginning of this presentation, it would be lovely to have more time to talk about how psychoanalysis has actually influenced and colonized the minds of people, but we just don't have time to get into that. What I do want to do at this point, though, in talking about lives of abundance and scarcity, is quote something from the writings of John McKnight, the founder of the Asset-Based Community Development Institute. And this comes from a lecture that he delivered in 1984, which was the fourth annual E.F. Schumacher lecture. And the lecture was entitled John Deere and the Bereavement Counselor. So I'm just going to read the last few paragraphs of the lecture, because I think it speaks very well to the question of scarcity and abundance. So it goes as follows. How will we learn to cultivate community again? It was E.F. Schumacher who concluded that the guidance we need can still be found in the traditional wisdom. Therefore, we can return to those who understand how to allow the prairie to bloom and to sustain as a people. So he's referring here to Native American Indians. And he says, one of the leaders of the Sook was a chief named Black Hawk. After his people were exiled to the land west of the Mississippi, and his resistance movement was broken at the Battle of Bad Axe. Black Hawk said of his Sioux Prairie home, "There was always plenty. Our children never cried for hunger. Neither were our people in want. The rapids of our river furnished us with the abundance of excellent fish. The land, being fertile, never failed to produce good crops or corn, beans, pumpkin, and squashes. Here our village stood for more than 100 years. Our village was healthy, and there was no place in the country possessing such advantages, no hunting grounds better than ours. If a prophet came to our land and told us that the days ahead would be as they had come to pass, we would have never believed the prophet." Then John McKnight goes on to quote a sister of Black Hawk, who tells what did actually come to pass. "The white people never cared for the land or deer or bear. When we kill meat, we eat it all. When we dig roots, we make little holes. When we build houses, we make little holes, but not of the white man. They cause the land to be sore. They destroy what they pass through. The spirit of the land hates them. They blast out trees and stir it up to its depths. They saw up the trees. The land hurts because of them. They blast rocks and scatter them on the ground. How could the land ever love the white man? How could it do anything but hate the white man? How can the spirit of the earth like the white man? Everything they have touched on the earth is now sore." Black Hawk and his Wintu sister tell us that the land has a spirit. Their community on the prairie was a people guided by that spirit. When John Deere's people came to Sioux Prairie, they exercised the prairie spirit in the name of a new god called technology. Because it was a god of their making, they believed they were gods themselves, and they made a desert of what once was a beautiful prairie land. There are still, though, incredible possibilities if we're willing to fail at being gods. And that's the point at the heart of what ABCD is calling us to be, is to actually be human beings, to go back again to human scale and start thinking about how we can get better at being human together. Part of the way of trying to figure out how to be better at human connectedness and human togetherness is the whole process of building community. The challenge is even community development and community building has become so corporatized in so many different ways. So much of how in the helping professions we have sought to build the capacity of people to be connected together has actually become to look very much like the institutions in the corporate world that we've tried to fight against and tried to challenge. I love this quote that you see in the slide here because I think it parodies everything that we're trying to avoid. And yet I think you might all recognize that so many of the helping professions actually behave this way. I'll read it to you. "Go to the people with an agenda. Find out what is wrong with them. Tell them what to do. Enable and fix them. Start with what they don't have. Boast about what you do. Tell them what you think and what they should know. But of the worst leaders, when the program is finished, the people will ask, what have they done to us?" You can probably guess this is a parody on the lovely quote from Lao Tzu, who says, "Go to the people, live among them, learn from them, love them. Start with what they know, build on what they have. But of the best leaders, when their task is done, the people will remark, we have done it ourselves." And I think there's a real challenge for a shift here. And the challenge is to shift away from a narrative that suggests that the only way the communities will get stronger or places where people live will get stronger is when governments and donors and partners come in to fix them. I think we've got to move to a situation where, if we're really serious about democracy, citizens are in the driving seat of the process, not as clients of the state, but centrally as the leaders of democracy, driving the agenda, telling donors, partners, and government how best to serve them. And I think that's a massive challenge in a consumer society where most people are not defining themselves as citizens who are co-creating the future on the basis of what they think is most important, but are actually in many respects thinking about their futures from the perspective of the client, the one who is supplicant and on his back, the one who is a passive consumer. This is a long-standing challenge, and it's not going to go away anytime soon or be easily removed, because this is actually about power. In 1929, this quote was furnished by Hoover, the president of the time, and he said, "Economically, we have a boundless field before us, that there are new wants which will make way endlessly for newer wants as fast as they are satisfied." In other words, what he was describing was an abundant opportunity for the world of commerce to take advantage and make money. That opportunity didn't just stop with the world of commerce. Many of the institutions from the 30s, 40s, 50s on that actually tried to address issues of public challenge or frame issues of public good actually formalized themselves in much the same way that institutions of for-profit did. In other words, we saw institutions of health, institutions of education, and institutions of justice actually start look terribly like this, where what they were producing in the name of health and well-being were actually products rather than public goods, where they actually started to look very much like businesses instead of stewards of democracy, where they actually started treating people like supplicant passive clients instead of recognizing people as citizens that they served. And eventually, as people became used to that way of being engaged with, many people themselves actually started functioning like clients. What we absolutely have to do, regardless of whether we're coming at this from the perspective of austerity or prosperity, abundance or scarcity, is we have to recognize that we have institutions currently that are organizing themselves as it suits them and are expecting us to organize our lives the way they're organized. The challenge, if we're going to build powerful communities and really build on the great work that's already going on in neighborhoods, is to ensure that the institutions that serve those neighborhoods organize themselves the way those people organize their lives, not the other way around. Currently, we, for the most part, see institutions organizing themselves in a way that's actually damaging and harmful to community. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges, because institutions have colonized people's lives in so many different ways, not just the for-profit, but also not-for-profit and public sector institutions. In the same way that the steel industry needs iron ore, public sector organizations and third sector organizations need people's needs. We would not exist in the professional helping world unless we had people's needs. Our challenge is not to go out and grow community. Community already exists. There are thousands and millions of hours worth of mutuality and support and activity already happening on the ground. It would be hubris in the extreme to assume that outside professional helpers are going to come in and suddenly build community. Community has been built on this planet since the emergence out of Africa 70,000 years ago. We do not need an expert to come in and show us how to build community. What we do need to ensure is that institutions, for-profit and not-for-profit, do no harm to community. And actually, the demise of community, if indeed it does come about, will come about not on the basis of the incapacity of citizens to connect and grow powerful together, but on the selfishness of institutions who are growing fat on the assets of community. We absolutely need to address the culture of institutions that have forgotten that actually they were hatched out of the nest of associational life. And I think that's what we're beginning to see. We're beginning to see institutions learning how to organize themselves in a different way. We're beginning to see people in institutions saying, we want to be free. We want to actually be less oriented in the organizing of data and hierarchy and power and privilege, and more oriented in organizing ourselves at human scale to be of use. Most people in institutions signed up to do something to make a difference. And I think that's particularly important now, because we can no longer have the luxury of thinking about the challenges we face in elemental terms. For a long, long time, we thought about health as separate from the environmental challenges we face, as separate from the democratic challenges that we face, as separate from the economic challenges that we face. We now know that's a complete and utter nonsense. It's the dumbest idea in the world. All of these things are interconnected in the same way that we are. And if we need proof, it abounds. One of the examples that really shows up the power of the interconnectedness of our lives and the emergent nature of the challenges, the complex nature of the challenges we face, is the heat wave of 2003, which claimed 70,000 lives across Europe. Most people don't even remember this happening. It's really interesting. And yet, you know, because of media coverage, we'll remember tsunamis and we'll remember other climactic changes, which didn't claim as many lives, but got more media coverage. That heat wave not alone claimed 70,000 lives across Europe, but actually taught us something profoundly important about the way we organize our world and we're organizing our society. 16,000 people died in Paris, or in France, and 6,000 died in Paris in a space of 2 weeks, the first 2 weeks of August. Now, one of the reasons that happened was because most professionals leave Paris during the first 2 weeks of August to go on holidays. But actually, after much study of this phenomenon, the primary cause of the deaths of people who perished during that period had little to do with service delivery and a lot to do with the absence of neighborliness or the absence of community. Most people who died were women living on their own in poor urban housing over the age of 65. Paris, France in general, boasts one of the best healthcare systems in the world. But actually, the challenge was a complex one. It didn't just require service intervention. It also required social capital and community intervention. More and more, the complex challenges we're facing are not going to be resolved by system solutions alone. One of my favorite books is a book called Last Man Over the Wall, which was written by Jerome Miller, who shut down many of the youth reformatories in the States. And he had a wonderful expression. He used to say of reformatories that incarcerated young men for crimes of various descriptions, largely a consequence of political disquiet and poverty. He said that the best thing I can do for those young men is the worst thing that can happen to them. And so he understood that his job as a reformer and as a radical bureaucrat was not to actually make sure that these kids had a good life when in prison, but to shut prisons down. And I think this is really important. Our institutions are not beacons of success. Many of our institutions are the worst thing that can happen to the people in them. We dream for community and we settle for institutions because, after all, we're clients, we're consumers. Only citizens actually build community. Clients build services. And of course, we need services. But the promise that services offer us is nearly always disquieting and unsettling and insufficient. It promises satisfaction, but there's so much more to life than services, so much more at stake. It promises perfection. It promises cures for cancer. It promises the good life. But again, as most of us know, you can't get a good life completely from a service. So while we've had a fine romance for many years with institutions and with professional interventions and with all kinds of money-based economy transaction, the truth of the matter is there are limits to our institutions. There are limits to what can be bought in the marketplace. And I think what we're beginning to realize, as many of these great institutions are actually beginning to crumble, is that, in fact, beyond those limits is a life of our choosing. A life that's not just about the self, that's not just about what we consume, but also a life that's defined by production, a life that's defined by strengths. You know that there's a hidden danger in every asset and in every strength. And I think that hidden danger is that if a strength doesn't find expression, if it doesn't find some way of coming out into the world and getting connected productively, I think our strengths turn on us. We've organized ourselves in communities, in schools, and in institutions in such a way as to ensure that most of our children, and indeed most of us, never get to play to our strengths, never get to celebrate the strengths of other people. We've organized our society in so many ways to the rule which says that if I win, you must lose. And that competitive culture, which is born out of consumerism, is actually really challenging community. So why is it then that at the moment we are seeing evidence of the resurgence of community? I think one of the reasons that we're seeing that is not just because the institutions are running out of money, but I think people are beginning to realize that institutions have created all kinds of unintended consequences, that institutions actually not alone have limits, but actually once they hit their limit, they can also be counterproductive. So we're now at an age where we recognize that many of our prisons are in fact the biggest mental health hospitals in our countries, that often they are crime-making prisons rather than places of justice and reform. Many of our schools are stupefying our children instead of educating them. And many of our hospitals are places that if you want to live, you don't go to. Now, that's broad, and I'm making sweeping generalizations. But if I had more time, I'd back every single statement up with a mountain of evidence. So what does this mean? I can't draw simple conclusions because there aren't simple conclusions. This is a complex discussion. And I love Mencken's quote when he says, for every subtle and complicated question, there's a perfectly simple and straightforward answer, which is wrong. So I'm not even going to try to give a simple answer. But what I do want to suggest is that I think we need to get clearer about what we mean by community. I started the presentation by suggesting one of the better definitions of community is the place where citizenship prevails, where we're not clients, but we're actually citizens. And I think it's interesting when you reflect on the evidence. Recently, there's lots of evidence. Demos have done some really interesting work around the link between localism and local activist contributions in our neighborhoods to democracy. But I was really struck by a piece of research that I read recently called Soul of Community, which was written by Knight Foundation and Gallupo. And they surveyed, over 3 years, they surveyed people, 43,000 people in 26 cities to try to understand, this is interesting, I think, what they wanted to understand was what were the determinants of economic success in a city? So they were essentially looking for, you know, the local GDP, what affects the local bottom line. And to their surprise, in every single city, in every single neighborhood, and with pretty much nearly every single person they talked to, they discovered that attachment was the primary determinant of local GDP. In other words, the extent to which people were connected together in the place that they lived their lives. And this is really profound, because what they're showing here is an almost causal link that's showing us something about how economies grow that has nothing at all to do with money. That's actually about gift economy rather than money economy. We've all been brought up in systems and educated to believe that before the money economy was the barter system. It's nonsense. There's absolutely no anthropological evidence to show that that was the case. And I would commend the work of Graeber, who has written a wonderful piece on the history of death, the first 5,000 years. It's a bit of a tome, but it's worth doing the work to read through it. Because what he shows convincingly is that economic narrative is a fiction. It is absolutely groundless. It's founded on nothing but the imaginations of a Scotsman. And effectively, what he shows us is that we have, for millennia, organized ourselves in community contexts, albeit tribal, on the basis of gift exchange. And that's what we're seeing in communities. We're seeing communities where we're walking all over the world, that it's when people identify what they have, their skills, the power of their associations, where they can connect with institutions that are prepared to act like treasure chests instead of fortress walls, and where they can connect properly with their ecology. In other words, where they can be place-based, where they can focus on their strengths, their assets, and where it's citizens who are in the lead. But actually, the outcomes are not alone good for mutuality and well-being, they're also good for democracy and for economic and environmental well-being. There's a hidden danger here, as there is with everything. I am seeing across the UK and indeed in other countries, people trying to appropriate the asset-based language, and indeed language like resilience, to excuse what I would say is absolutely and utterly heinous and objectionable, and I would say almost verging on criminal behavior. And certainly, at the very least, if I'm being kind, the abdication of their responsibility as elected people to serve the citizenry, as people in positions of power and privilege, who are basically, I think, telling people to use their assets because they're not prepared to use the resources and share the resources that they have. So using asset-based community development language to excuse the abdication of responsibility is something I think we must absolutely abjure, and we must challenge at every hand's turn. Because social justice is at the heart of the asset-based approach. It's challenging people not alone to use the assets that they have or build on the resilience of the easy to include, but it's challenging people to reach to the edge and to welcome the stranger who typically is excluded, to really look to the gifts and the resources of every human being, and to recognize that there is nobody that is not needed when it comes to building a community. And that's why I really believe we have not had a golden age of community. So we're not talking about bonded capital. We're talking about bridging social capital. We're talking about reaching beyond the issues that stand as kind of issues of the tribal day, and really thinking about how we can create societies where everybody can get included. And that's a big challenge, because an awful lot of people who think seriously and deeply about the world would say that, you know, from a social justice perspective, you cannot change the world from a street. If you want to change the world, you've got to occupy Wall Street, not your street. I would challenge that. I'd say the truth of the matter is it's not either or, but it's both and. I love the way Nesta have been thinking about this in relation to their work around mass localism and environmental impacts. I think we can make the journey from the bees to the trees. I think we can actually make a journey from hyperlocal, where people connect and build on the issues that they care about, and then to organize at a much broader scale to begin to influence democracy, the economy, and environmental change. But that means thinking in a very, very different way. It means organizing money in a very different way. It means commissioning in a very different way. And it means decommissioning. We have a possibility here, and it's not too wild a dream. And the possibility is that we could, in fact, enable every single neighborhood in every single country to identify its resources, to connect those resources, and to mobilize those resources so that they could set out their own vision for their future. And when they reach the limits of their local resources, they can use the assets that they have mobilized to co-produce with outside agencies the results that they can't create on their own. And also to use that power, the power that grows from securing the capacity and the resource to identify problems and then solve them, to hold outside agencies to account, to remind outside agencies that they are the servants and that we as the citizens are the landlords. It's possible, and it's my dream, over the next 30 years, I reckon I have about 30 years left of work in me, to do something meaningful about making sure that competent, useful, and credible resources go into neighborhoods to allow local people to identify, connect, and mobilize their assets, but also to build a vision and a plan so that they can hold outside agencies to account and leverage in the external resources that match those assets in a way that doesn't build on healthy dependency. This doesn't mean agencies are bad. It doesn't mean that citizens are good. That's silly, that's simple, and we're talking about something that's complicated. What it does mean is that agencies are limited. There are things that they can do and there are things that they can't. It also means that citizens are limited. There are things that we can't do at neighborhood level that we need help with. I think we're coming to an age when we realize that we need to renegotiate the social contract. We need to get clarity around accepting that there are things that we must do as citizens, that if we don't do them, they won't get done, that there is no service surrogate for these things. But there are also things that agencies must do. So how can we have a democratic conversation that allows everybody to have a view, but also allows everybody to bring the skills and the capacities they have to bear in doing something about that? Well, I think that's about hyper-local community building. I think that's about helping people to make connections, not based on being a client requiring services, not based on the narrative that says the only way that things are going to get better around here is if somebody comes in and makes them better, but a narrative that says, let's use what we have to secure what we need. And once we've done that, let's draw in the external resources to match it. I think the way of doing that is ensuring that there's a community builder in every neighborhood who can actually support communities to connect. Because the truth of the matter is, people died in 2003 in neighborhoods that have lost the capacity to connect. That doesn't mean that there are bad people in those neighborhoods. It means that there's a critical mass of people who've become atomized and disconnected. We need to do something about that. We're spending billions servicing people, going into neighborhoods and aggregating people by need, youth at risk, frail elderly, ex-prisoners. You know the labels as well as I do. We identify them, we aggregate them, we put them in institutions, and largely we fail them. Well, sometimes that needs to be done. Sometimes we need institutions. But there's a missing ingredient here in social change. And that's when we go into communities and we build communities for community's sake, not with any agenda, but simply because more connected neighborhoods lead to healthier, more democratic, more environmentally sustainable, and, according to the soul of community, more economically vibrant realities and lives for the people who live in them. Place fundamentally matters because place is where all of the different agendas that so many of us are paid to work on come together. It's the place that allows us to get outside our silos. I've had the privilege of working all over the world, from Rwanda to Portugal to most recently just back from some work in the Netherlands. And what strikes me is, while we're profoundly different as human beings, we have huge common ground as well. And it's the stage of place that allows us to actually begin to grow the very fabric of democracy from the street right up. So I suppose my sense of it is that as well as occupying Wall Street, we need to learn again to occupy our street. We can wait until the systems change. We can wait until our leaders get their act together. But you know, I'm actually not prepared to wait. While people are trying to figure out the perfect Trojan horse to break into the city walls, I'm much more interested in becoming a Trojan mouse. I'm much more interested in finding the entry points. I'm much more interested in disruptive innovation. And the crazy thing is, it seems to me that maybe the most innovative thing I can do these days is actually start talking to my neighbors, actually start finding out what they care about enough to act upon. And that's what I'll be talking about on May 16th, how to do that systematically and why it is over the last 4 years, for example, in Croydon, we've moved to a situation where now we're seeing hundreds and hundreds of people who previously were not engaged in community life or in democratic life, now engaged, leading all kinds of social change. If we told them that the only way they could get engaged was wait first for the system to change, they'd never ever engage. But what we said instead was, tell us what you care about enough to act upon. Tell us what skills you have that you'd like to use to do that, and then we'll support you. You know, communities are like football matches where you've got 22 people who least need the exercise doing all the work and 3,000 people who most need the exercise telling them what to do. But the solution isn't to get those 3,000 people playing football. Their passion is telling footballers what to do. What we've got to do is find a way to organize ourselves as a society that allows us to hear what people care about And at the moment, all we're really doing is doing inventories of misery, going in and finding out what's wrong, what's broken, what's problematic. If we can shift the narrative away from a focus on what's wrong to what's strong, then we have the possibility of using what's strong to address what's wrong and make what's strong stronger. And what I'm beginning to see is that agency after agency after agency is realizing that using a service-based model alone is not going to cut the mustard. As well as providing services, we've got to learn how to grow community. And that's about relationships. That's about working at human scale. The road ahead, inevitably, will address three questions as we see the resurgence of community. The first is, what is it we can do with civic community power, with the people, 80% of whom are non-constituted, will never apply for lottery funding. We're just getting on with their lives, but also think about their neighbors. How can we connect with them? Not in a way that just organizes screen walks to school, although that's a lovely thing to do, or other such nice, fluffy things, but in a way that actually recognizes that the power of democracy is founded in what they're doing. Hitler understood this. He understood that his best hope of seizing power was to actually destroy associational life, was to get to that 80% of democracy that was not formally constituted or institutionalized, and turn the Scouts movement into Hitler Youth. Because you see, that's the locus of freedom. That's where we're not paid, but where we do things by consent. And democracy is primarily predicated on two things: the freedom of expression and the freedom of association. That's not just about the right to consume, but also the right to produce. In the final analysis, we will create a revolution and sustain the rise of community when people who've been defined as the problem secure the power to redefine the problem. Because innately and instinctively, every human being knows that you can't know what you need until you first know what you have.